Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
I'm Mikey. Nice to meet you all. I am a software engineer who hasn't written code in a few years, but I have been working with a bunch of different federal and DoD organizations over the years, building things like software factories and achieving things like continuous ATO. I worked on the first Air Force project back in the day that became Kessel Run, and then was involved with Kessel Run for a long time, and been working with Space Force and now with Army Futures Command building the software factory. I don't know if folks are coming from the ribbon cutting ceremony for that thing, but that's who I am. I'm Mikey. I am particularly passionate about this subject, security in the federal space. As a software engineer working with the federal government, what I learned very quickly was, I thought, this working in the commercial sector is you build software and you put it in production and then your users use it and they give you feedback. And then you iterate based on what they tell you. But in the federal government, it's not quite that easy. You got to get through some wickets and security becomes very difficult. And I think what I maybe learned is that a lot of software organizations in the past just say, well, if I got to go through that whole process, I'll put that process way, way, way at the end of my build phase. So I only have to deal with it one time. And then a bunch of risk builds up and budgets overextend, timelines drag to the right, and software programs tend to fail. And so solving for that problem of marrying up security with speed, I think is the way that we unlock like real transformation, real agile software delivery in the federal space. This conversation, in my view, is central to unlocking real speed and digital transformation in the federal sector. So thank you all for hanging out. I wonder if we could just quickly go around the horn with some of our panel speakers, and maybe you can just kick to others. Maybe I'll start with Chris Hughes. Chris, want to introduce yourself and say hello? State your name and where are you from?
Chris Hughes, Virginia Beach, Virginia. I've been in the cybersecurity career field / community for about almost 15 years now. Started off in active duty Air Force, ended up working as a Navy civilian with NIWC Atlantic for some time. Also worked for GSA as part of FedRAMP and some activity around their TTS and cloud-based systems. Right now I'm with an organization called Rise 8, focused on cloud security, DevSecOps, digital transformation. In addition to that, participate in the Cloud Security Alliance DC, where I lead their membership community, and also teach at University of Maryland Global Campus and Capital Technology University.
Good Lord. How many hours a week do you work?
He doesn't sleep.
Oh yeah, my kids make sure I don't sleep. this is a break from the kids.
Unreal. All right, who are we kicking to?
Let's go with Lanye.
Hola, everyone. Lanye Ford. I am the CEO of Arlo Solutions. I have my other co-founder on here. She's the R, I'm the low. As far as my background, I came up in the Air Force. I left Chicago when I was 19 and went to this horrible place called Italy. Where I started working at the help desk. So I went from help desk to small computers to being a wire dog and pulling cable. I just highlight that because my focus area is assess and authorize. So I would say I am an RMFer. And typically in the past, doing assess and authorize, we have always assessed and authorized technology that we've touched before, that we've used, that we've built. Now it's like, hey, RMFer, go tell me how to secure this code. you know? And so that's, we're not developers. I had never, you know, pushed code to production. And so I think we're in a very unique space of needing collaboration. So that's why it's so important for us to have these type of forums so that we can have those conversations, because Mikey, you developers talk Spanish and we're talking French over here. So how do we translate, right? And so that, and that's the part that I'm passionate about. I'm passionate about collaboration, collaborating to really get after hard problems. I'm not interested in coding, but there's a lot of importance in that if I'm going to assess and authorize it. So just bringing the right people, you know, to the table. So look forward to this, look forward to this collaboration.
Awesome. Lanier, who are you kicking to?
Alex, the guy with the best microphone on here.
Yeah, right. you all will be the judge. It's funny that you, Lanier, that you kicked to me, because I'm a prior service Air Force linguist. And I think I am on this call in that I am whatever the opposite of an RMFer is. I have almost no compliance background other than me yelling at Steve why he's telling me that I have to do something that doesn't make any sense based on the code that I'm writing. But he says that's the rules, and so I just had to follow them. And so, yeah, my role here at VMware has evolved to be one to where I try and do that translation from French to Spanish and try to help our customer orgs speak with their own development teams and speak to us when we're in there trying to help enable them. Because at the end of the day, I don't think that compliance works without, you know, actual implementation of the security and vice versa. So hopefully I can be a good voice in that domain. Go ahead, Steve.
I think that leaves me as the anchor. So first of all, Mikey, thanks for putting together a panel of exclusively Air Force mindshare leaders here. This is awesome. This is a multi-service community, and yet this is a 100% Air Force panel. So this is awesome. Nice way to go. I'm Steve. I currently work for Oracle. I do. I help customers, you know, in their transition, typically into public cloud. So how do I move my workloads securely into public cloud? And a lot of that focuses on cloud native workloads and things like that. In past lives, I spent a lot of time with folks like Alex and Mikey, really wrestling with this conversation with how do you marry up this idea of speed and agility and security and compliance. I always like to remind folks, security is not compliance and compliance is not security. They're two sides of the same coin, right? And they're trying to achieve some of the same objectives, but they aren't the same. And we actually have a goal of achieving both in our agile and our speed of developing software well for the military. We want it to be secure, right? We don't want flaws and vulnerabilities in our code. We also want it to be compliant. And so how we do that at speed with agility is that's nirvana. As I like to say, that's the purple squirrel unicorn we're all after. So it's really a lot of fun helping organizations think about new ways of really achieving both outcomes. How do I write secure code that is compliant at speed and that meets the warfighter's needs in a real-time way, right? So there's a lot of fun working in that space.
Awesome. Did we invite anybody else to the party here? Are we kicking anyone else, or is this the group?
This is it.
That's it, yeah.
Okay, sweet. Welcome, y'all. This is super exciting. Again, huge passion area for mine as a software engineer, because I agree with what Steve just said. Got to get software into production in order to have any meaningful value delivered at all. And to do that, it needs to be compliant and it needs to be secure. So with that, I'm going to like act as, I don't know, the person asking questions or trying to keep the conversation going. But you know, don't be afraid to just talk amongst yourselves, and I'll just throw in things here and just try to keep the flywheel turning. So, and others, if you have questions, put them in the chat or just chime in and interrupt. I mean, please let's make this as much of a conversation as we possibly can. So, with that, I'll throw the first pitch here. Is it continuous ATO or is it continuous RMF?
First, I would say this. One of the main challenges I see in our environment, I would have to say, is lexicon. And I think we really struggle with understanding terms. And we don't, again, we're not speaking that same language. I am a fan of frameworks in general. So when I think of continuous RMF, RMF is a framework, where a CATO is more a type of authorization. So what framework do you use to get after that, to get after that authorization? But, you know, and I think when we talk about continuous ATO, which everyone now wants it, it's a very sought after authorization type, even when people are not prepared. I think what we should be really talking about is a continuous monitoring, you know, so if that's truly, to me, the foundation of getting to a continuous ATO. The term continuous ATO is synonymous with ongoing authorizations, and that has been out there. That is not a new concept. But we've kind of coined that term specifically for, software development. And it is a hard bar to reach. I think people look at it, and maybe because we're talking broad stroke, oh, people processing technology, that should be simple. No, it's actually a very difficult bar to reach. And a lot of the difficult part is around the people, to me, you know, because you do have expertise around a lot of these tools. But what we don't really focus on is the cultural change that's required to get after something like a continuous ATO. Us cyber folks are used to talking to cyber folks, right? We're siloed. We haven't learned how to communicate to, again, a developer and to on the operations side of the house. We haven't thought through and talked to the program manager to say, what is the intent of this tool? We're typically used to getting this thing delivered to us, that they assess this thing at a point in time and it's over. Not that that was effective, because it wasn't, but now we have to learn how to really move to the left. And I think continuous ATO is also difficult because we really have to focus on acquisitions and contracts. And that may be a conversation for another time, but the acquisition side of, you know, continuous ATO is, it's not about baking it in. You have to bake that into the requirement, right? Security into the requirement. So I do say continuous ATO, not continuous RMF, but continuous risk management versus continuous RMF, I think is appropriate. You really focus on continuous monitoring.
Yeah, so I'm going to be the first to disagree. Go ahead, Steve. I'm going to be the first to disagree. I like to actually change language intentionally to change behavior, right? And so ATO has been around a while. And frankly, to be honest, every ATO is a continuous ATO. It has a 3-year life cycle typically. And within that life cycle, it's continuous. And so to introduce new behavior, I think it's actually useful to introduce new language. And so instead of saying continuous ATO, which also, to be fair, most organizations interpret it way different ways. Like, nobody actually can consistently define what continuous ATO means across different organizations, right? I actually do like what Lanya said there at the end, continuous risk management. So if you take the F off, I think she would agree. If you took the F off of continuous RMF, she might like the term better. I like to use continuous RMF because RMF is something we all know, right? So it's like taking something we know, adjusting the language a little bit, and then trying to flip the script on it. At the end of the day, I do think it is about continuous risk management, building that continuous risk management into your overall life cycle. But then the authorization side has to recognize that there are mechanisms for continuously managing the risk, and that it is not, to your point, it's not a one-time event, it's a continuous event. And how we then adjust our things like ANA, assess and authorize. Assess and authorize has to significantly change when you're talking about continuous risk management, because it's no longer a discrete event, right? That happens once every 3 years or even once a month, right? It literally happens every code push. And so our approach to assess and authorize actually has to change with it to achieve those continuous risk management outcomes.
Yeah, I was going to add, not to necessarily disagree with either of them, but as Lanya said, like, ongoing authorization, you know, is part of the lexicon that's been around for quite some time. And I think it's important not to get too wrapped around the axle of you know, the verbiage of things, the language of things. You know, it is important, but at the same time, we're focused on outcomes. You know, what are we ultimately trying to get after? which is getting away from that cyclical 3-year cycle of, okay, it's good to go. You know, we'll kind of reassess it again in 3 years, instead having that ongoing continuous monitoring, continuous risk management, as they're saying, and you know, making that part of the process and the culture. You know, the tooling is there and it's in policy. It's just a matter of changing the way we approach the situation.
Fascinating. Anybody else have thoughts or should I? Go ahead, Lonnie.
I mean, I would, and I want to go back and I maybe kind of had this discussion with this team, specifically to what you just mentioned, Steve, about, you know, you do think that, you know, changing the lexicon is, you know, is helpful to, you know, really, and I know what you're getting at, right? Once you change the lexicon, it starts allowing us to kind of color outside, you know, kind of color outside the lines, because we're accustomed to following this process. But what I've noticed on the DOD side of the house is that once you add these terms that we are not level set on, people truly don't know how to put a process around it. It's very, very difficult from a reciprocity standpoint. It's difficult for a person who's assessing and authorized to have a conversation with someone outside of that circle. So I've seen internal to the programs that, especially in DevSecOps, right? Because we talk, what is DevSecOps? What is CI/CD pipeline? What is CATO? What is DSOP? I mean, you hear this broken, these terminologies used in so many different ways, and people come with different perceptions and expectations based off of them. So, you know, it would be helpful in my mind to have a level set, even if it's new terminology, right? It can be new terms that we add, but we have to find a way to level set so that we're all speaking that same language.
Between on that, if I can pull the thread between you and Steve here, do you guys think, given that, you know, language matters, right, and we need to have that common terminology, do you think it's important that we have definitive guidance from the DOD to facilitate continuous authorization, you know, continuous ATO, whatever you want to call it? Do we need that definitive guidance, or should it be more flexible up to the organization, agency, program, et cetera? What do you both think?
It's a great question, Mikey. We're taking you off the rails here. I was just going to say, if you wanted a better question, we should have gone with, is it DevOps or is it DevSecOps? Because I have strongly held opinions about that topic.
Let's go there next.
Yeah, but Chris, to answer your point, I think it's both. So we get in this world, especially in the DOD, right? The DOD, let's be fair, we love our rules and regulations. We love our standard operating procedures. We love our TTPs, like, right? Everything is awesome in the DOD. And yet, right, you often hear about how we need, you know, agility in the battlefield, right? So it's really interesting how you have to like take this idea, right? We have a battle plan, we have a strategy, we have tactics, but when feet hit the ground, right, when we're in the midst of the fight, then you've got to have that agility. And so I think the answer to your question is both. I think we ultimately need some guardrails. You'll also hear I love the word guardrails, right? It helps keep us inside, you know, off the electric fence. We need some guardrails that establish some top level kind of broad parameters for what does this, you know, continuous authorization, continuous risk management, what does it really look like? What are the don't exceeds, you know, kind of from a DOD perspective? And then let individual organizations color within those lines, right? Like find their way within those guardrails that keep them from, you know, electrifying themselves, but give them the flexibility to achieve their mission, right, you know, as their battlefield needs it. Because what space needs is not the same as what Army needs, right? If you're putting an agile software project in the back of a Humvee, it's not like putting it on a rocket and shooting it into space or putting it on a satellite. These are a significantly different, you know, things. And so I think we need to allow some flexibility within those things.
Alex, right. Are you going to come in?
Yeah, I am potentially going to fork this slightly in that I don't have a skin in the game, so to speak, of CRMF versus CATO from the perspective of people that are actually trying to implement the compliance regulations. I think it's important that we have a common vernacular. I do agree that, like, it is confusing when you go from org to org. It makes things more complicated. You're like, what does it mean? But like at the end of the day, I hope that we don't get too lost in like the outputs, because what I sometimes hear people say when we say CRMF is they're like, well, you know, RMF has continuous monitoring built into it. And me, as trying to help people implement these security controls, I'm like, yo, but I need y'all like like 3 years the other direction. I needed you over there. Like, we're talking about CM, but I'm talking about the very beginning when we started, and I needed you to help me understand like what network things could I inherit, what actually makes sense in this environment versus me just going it on my own and building it and then showing up at the end at your doorstep. And I'm like, dang, like we missed the whole show because we were thinking about how we were going to manage it at the end. And so I think when we say continuous ATO, like holy loaded term, right? I mean, so much weight can go into that into so many different audiences, but I hope we find the right term to talk about. Is it DevSecOps? Is it DevOps? I don't know if I want to go that route right now, but.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm going to circle, Mike, I know you're going to jump in, but I'm going to just circle back to Chris's question as well about, you know, do we feel that DOD should put out kind of more policy and guidance prescriptive? I love policy processes, procedures, because, you know, coming up in the Air Force, you have such a diverse workforce and skill set. And when I mean diverse, I mean skill set wise, from beginner to, you know, senior level. And so trying to develop these processes, I went through this when developing Fast Track, right? People, you start off with saying, and that leadership wanted to allow people to think, is what they told me. I'm just going to put out this one memo and I'm going to tell them these are the intents and I'm going to allow people to think. Ask me how many people adopted that process. None. Because, you know, it was, they didn't know how to implement. People say that they do not want you to be prescriptive, but if you don't provide enough details, it is very difficult from an implementation standpoint. And then in the DOD world, we're so focused on also compliance. And so it's like, okay, I'm gonna do this process. It's not, you know, crosswalk to any compliance or statutory. Am I really meeting the requirements? So people are very slow to adopt if you don't provide that kind of top cover. So I think that's important. And I also see the way the DOD going is much better. I worked at the kind of CIO CISO level for quite some time. Now I'm back also supporting programs like the F-35 and some of our major acquisition programs, doing that DevSecOps, the assessments for DevSecOps. But working at these DAF areas and for DOD, the people writing those policies, they haven't touched the damn system in 10 years. So, you know what, it is great on paper, but if we don't collaborate, which I'm going to say a bunch of times, but if we don't collaborate with the Alexes and Mikeys of the world, you're going to get this just document that no one can implement. It probably doesn't even make sense. And so I do think that it's important that we have that policy and guidance, but I also think that it's important that we mature the process to getting after that and making sure that we're doing a better job of collaborating broadly, even external to our agencies. Go ahead, Mike.
I was just gonna say I'll let you go, Mike. I was gonna say that's the dichotomy here, is like you need some kind of prescriptive guidance, right, to give people some direction. But if you have it, if it's too heavy-handed, you stifle any kind of creative thinking or innovation that you might have come out of that situation as well. And as you said, a lot of times the problem is the policy is being written by people who are not practitioners, and there's a disconnect. And I'll throw it back to Mike now.
Yeah. All right. So with that, I mean, you all are kind of already talking around this, but. I have a hypothesis here. I've been around this space for I don't know how many years now, and I've seen and implemented continuous delivery in government with continuous ATO. I feel like I can count. Everyone is talking about continuous ATO in the federal government. Everyone claims to have one, or is getting one, or is doing it, or whatever, right? Like everybody's got it and wants it. But I feel like I can only count on one hand the number of people who are actually putting software in production continuously with this ongoing authorization. Why is that?
I think it, and I don't know if this was Steve that said this, but I'll use another term. Is, you know, people kind of want this utopia. I think they, you know, that is, you know, number one, I think it's kind of a bandwagon thing. Also, people realize that it is difficult. I am currently working across three different programs with the goal of getting a CATO. And we've been working across those programs for over a year, and we're still in testing phase. And so I do think that that's where people want to go, but they don't understand how difficult it is. And again, a lot of that difficulty to me comes around culture. you know, not the technology, you know, from a tools perspective and developers. And I've been working on continuous ATO now for just about a year. I think also what's hard to implement is a little ego. I say that because many people do not like to admit when they don't know things, right? I've been in RMF for, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years. I'm not going to ask that developer, you know, what does this mean? You know, I'm the expert. And so this thing, we build these barriers because we are afraid to admit that we may not be strong in one area versus I know you've been developing code for 20 years. You know, I've been looking at this for a year, but I've been doing risk assessments for 20 years. How about we come together and collaborate? And I tell you, hey, from an assessment standpoint, this is what I want. You tell me from a developer standpoint, okay, this is what I can do to give you that. And right. We start collaborating. And I think that's what's making it very difficult for people to implement. The cyber folks are saying, hey, no developer, give me all these papers. And a developer is, wait a minute, use GitHub. Wait a minute, I'm not going to type up, you know, a 50-page SSP. This doesn't make sense. You're taking me back to the Stone Ages. But what's that middle ground?
I want to hop in really quick here, Lanya, because I think there's two sides to this coin, right? Your hypothesis, I think, about like a hubris or a you know, a lot of change coming at and it's hard to stomach and you really have to collaborate to get it right. But that requires an immense amount of vulnerability and in typically command and control architectures that make it really difficult to be like, I just don't know. I may be the SES around here, but I don't know. And it goes both ways because it goes with developers needing to be willing to say, hey, Chris, I know that the thing says I'm supposed to do this, but like, that's going to take me 6 years. Can we talk about how we can mitigate that? Like, is there anything I can do here? Or do I really have to build this thing for the next 6 years? And then like, that's the only way we're ever going to get to prod. And you might be like, well, actually there's this thing over here, or we can POAM it, but there has to be a two-way conversation and has to be vulnerable and willing to admit where you're in the red and be willing to work through the red. And that's all a requirement if you're going to actually implement this true, like modern agile way of building software. Because there's going to be red everywhere you look, because there is either way. If you don't say it's there, I promise you it's there. But let's at least talk about it and put it in the open.
I was going to go back to your question, Mikey, which is why does everybody want to do this? I blame Brian Kroger. The reason everybody wants to do this is the success of the projects that have actually demonstrated that it works, right? So I would say, you know, the early folks attempting this in the DoD, certainly like the Kessel Run folks and the other trailblazers, they've spent enough time and energy, you know, A, demonstrating that it can work, and B, demonstrating the impact on the warfighter. That's why everybody in the DoD wants it. And then so outside hang on, I'll be the DoD. Clear here.
I'm not suggesting, like, I wonder why everybody wants this. I think
okay.
My perspective, I understand why people want it. What I think I don't understand is why everybody is claiming they're doing it or are just about to do it.
Well, it's because they want it on their performance review.
You think I'm joking?
No, it also comes back to what they said is that a lot of folks may not understand exactly what it is, or they have a misunderstanding of what it is. So they may be claiming that they're doing something that they don't even truly understand. And it you know, and part of why many people aren't doing it is because it's not such a simple task, as Lanya pointed out. It's a cultural change. You know, it's changes to technology. It's changing the processes. It's upskilling your workforce or bringing in additional resources to help facilitate new ways of doing things. It's not just some click bang, you know, done. We're doing CATO now. It's a major transformation.
Yeah, I agree. And I know I keep going back to a collaboration, but working in terms of the programs, another thing that's different is you are now working with a lot more as a contractor. You are having to collaborate and work with a lot of different vendors. And so you may have one vendor that is creating this infrastructure. And then once they develop it and they deliver it, it's another vendor that's doing O&M. Those two vendors may not have even spoken. So if someone's trying to assess, okay, I'm assessing the infrastructure, but I need some operational data. Are you scanning? Are you patching? Well, the person creating the infrastructure is like, no, I'm not. Right. So it's a lot of, you know, even from that perspective, and that one environment is more, and then there may be another, you know, vendor that's focused on integration. And so, you know, really that truly makes it difficult too, from a collaboration standpoint. And where we used to be, where the government was either developing or it was delivered Now what I'm seeing is when you're working with certain companies, you're a contractor working for the government, there are certain information they do not want to provide to you. They don't want to tell you that's their IP. You know, they don't want to really talk to you about how they're maybe developing code, or are we going to let you assess my code? And, you know, and we haven't really tackled some of that from an acquisition and contractual standpoint on how do we assess that if the vendor is very private with how this was developed. You know, and that's also becoming kind of difficult from an assessment standpoint.
Fascinating. So there's a couple of questions piling here. Chris, do you want to jump in?
I was just going to say one thing that Alex and Lanyang went back and forth on is about, you know, being vulnerable and having that culture where you can say, I simply don't know something. You know, as part of the principles of, you know, DevOps, you know, Agile, things like that is, you know, having the ability to experiment. And I think that starts at the top with leadership, you know, letting the culture of the organization know that, like, you can get things wrong. It's okay to learn. This is a learning endeavor, and letting people know that you can be transparent. You can have, you know, vulnerability. It's okay. It's part of the process of the cultural transformation, basically.
So that kind of leads me to what my next question was going to be. And I'm looking at Michael Storr's question, and I think that it's sort of asking the same thing. I want to ask like two questions at once. It's like, how do you do it, right? One is like, how do you do it? I think I agree with Lanyang that contractually in the acquisition process, you have to set the right conditions at the beginning, or else you're fighting against your contractual obligations. I also think that your AO or your CISO or somebody very high up needs to provide the top cover for those below to have the latitude to do what Lanyang you're saying, collaborate. And then there's like the actual process itself. Like what is the actual process for putting the first push into production, the second push into production, the third push in production? So I wonder if y'all could just kind of, you know, go back and forth here on what is like, if you were going to prescribe literally, here's a new organization from acquisition to leadership, to latitude, to actual, here is how you push the first thing into production and the second thing in production. What is that?
My biggest suggestion is the number one thing I encourage organizations or I push for from people that I work with is you need to have a clear, tangible, measurable objective. And it can't be, I want to do CATO or whatever. It's please give me a clear problem set, something that you actually have the means within your sphere of influence as an organizational leader to impact. If it's one problem domain, if it's a legacy app, if it's something, start there and be like, this is not delivering outcomes to my mission, like users. And like, we need to make it better, because at the end of the day, no story is as powerful to Congress, to your leaders, as when you say like, we are now, you know, Mikey, I mean, you can tell Tinkerplanner all day and there's, you know, we are now saving X lives. We are now saving $1 million, whatever the case may be. But if you say I got CATO, like I'm hoping to Steve's point, there are less people putting that on their, you know, OPRs or whatever, and more people focused on how am I going to actually steer my org? How will I know we've gotten off track? You'll know because you have a clear objective and it's set and you know how to measure it.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Alex says, like tying that, to, you know, starting with the business use case, what are we trying to achieve instead of just, you know, CATO for the purpose of our resume or, you know, advancement of some sort, tying it to a business outcome, a business objective. And then there's some things that, you know, we haven't talked to and tactically that we'll get to in a moment, I'm sure, is like things such as inheritance of security controls, shared controls between service providers, implementing tool chains, you know, aligned with AO risk thresholds so that you can repeatedly, you know, push code through pipelines and have it aligned with AO's risk tolerances, for example. Those are some of the tactical things I think they need to be discussed. And then I'll definitely open it up for Steve and Lanyang to speak as well.
Go for it, Lanyang.
Okay. I just would echo what both Alex and Chris said. I think you know, really now we are truly understanding that, you know, our IT and our cyber are enablers and we're not over here on this island on our own. And so, and you know, you're going to hear me say this again about collaboration and stakeholders, but
I'm glad you said it. I was waiting for the word.
Exactly. But it's important that now you start before we get to hey, I want to move to and transition to this process. Really think about your environment. Number one, what is your problem set? Why is it that you want to, you know, why is it that you want to pivot to doing something else so that you can make sure you're developing a process that implements that? I think we hold ourselves back as far as cybersecurity program development. I think we do have the frameworks in place, but it's not, when people give RMF this, it gets a bad name, I feel, but you know, it is a framework, right? And I think that, you know, we could really use that. Like if you look at 837 Rev 2, they have the process in there for prepare, the prepare step. And we're using this in USDA. And so looking at that, even before you decide to pivot, look at, is my organization prepared? You know, do I understand the roles and responsibilities? And not only that, do I understand what training is required? An area that I think we really lack on is workforce development. We put a lot of money in R&D. We put a lot of money in technology, but we don't put a lot of money in right-sizing our workforce. And so we lag behind there. So not only understanding why you want to pivot, does my workforce have the ability to do this? Do we have the correct skill sets? Do I need to get people trained? And so I think those are some of the questions that, you know, that we have to ask as we pivot. And then you can develop an authorization strategy, you know, based off that. And it doesn't have to be continuous ATO. You can say, hey, I'm going to authorize my stack or my infrastructure and platform. And as I integrate applications in here, I'm just going to do an application assessment process that doesn't go to the AO because I understand, I've asked those questions and understand their threshold. And so maybe some of our authorizations can be delegated down to an ISM, which saves us time, right? So I think really understanding what that problem set is and how do you appropriately streamline that for your particular stakeholders in that environment.
Let me think and see if I can repeat back what I just heard. I think what y'all are saying is that here's the formula for achieving a continuous ATO in your federal agency. Focus on a mission problem that you're going to solve so that it. You know, continuous ATO is not an outcome. So given you've started with that, then it is put together a contract that creates a shared responsibility between all the various players in the formula and doesn't result in this like over the wall passing and saying, I can't, you know, I only do this part and you do that part. You have to set up the contract such that all the different groups in this puzzle must collaborate. And that contract allows for an iterative delivery against requirements as opposed to a, you know, long arced, firm fixed pricey sort of, you know, 10-year timeline thing. So you've got the contract set. Then you have the AO and the CISO supportive of a policy that pushes responsibility down to lower levels like the ISMs. Given you have that, then it is basically a negotiation between the ISM side of the world and the developer side of the world to determine the process that they're going to use, given the AO and the CISO have set that condition above. And then from there, it's basically putting in place a tactical process, which consists of something like tool chains, CI pipelines, security scans, inheritance, and some sort of schedule or process for continuous monitoring. Like that's it, right? Is that it?
There's a couple pieces I'd add to that from what everybody was saying. First off, in your middle part there, where you talked about the ISM and the developer, it's included in there is the assess and authorize team, right? That is not, so the ISM tends to not be part of the assess and authorize team. So there's actually three parties in that conversation. There's the folks writing the code. There's the ISM who is their, ultimately their kind of security, you know, oversight organization. And then there's the third party, right? The independent assess and authorize organization. And that's where, you know, historically my perspective is that some of the historic authority that's been delegated to the ANA org has to be pushed down even as far as into the developer team, right? So they're actually, some of you have worked on projects I've been involved in, heard of this new position I've tried to create in these teams, which is called the AppSec Validation Engineer, which is a three-parter. It's part part ISM, part developer, and part A&A person, right? Kind of doing some really detailed hands-on work. I think that's it. But it's bringing together those three functions, Mikey. So it's not two, it's three that need to come together in that piece. And then to highlight what Lanya said, look, this is at the heart of it, you've got to have some workforce enablement, right? We cannot take classic people who think of continuous monitoring as looking at patch and vulnerability reports and move them into an agile software development organization. These are not the same skill set.
Just drop the mic right there.
Steve. Yeah.
Drop mic. So yeah.
You've got to train people or find trained people, right? To do this different kind of work, which is not looking at McAfee scans and HBSS output and Nessus scans once a month. That is not continuous monitoring for an agile software development organization.
I just wanted to foot stomp something that Steve said. I've been in the position of it is, you know, working when I was a civilian at the time. And if you're working with assessors in particular who don't understand the cloud native architectures, you know, shared responsibility models, control inheritance, all those kind of factors, it can be incredibly complicated and difficult to get a system to production and authorized. So you need a workforce, as they're both saying, you need a workforce that understands new technologies, new ways of doing things. It's not going to happen with the old way of approaching things and the old resources.
Totally agree. And not only we need to right size our workforce, sometimes we need to see, is it some additions we need to make to the workforce? Right now I'm working with, again, a few programs, getting at the CATO. Also had the pleasure of working with the DSOG as we look at the CATO process. But I title myself on the programs as an AO liaison. And because I'm not truly on the assess and authorize side of this process, I'm not truly on the program side. I look at my goal as I'm going to collaborate and make this thing happen by any means necessary, right? And I'm going to make sure that when I hear what the AO says is the threshold, how I have the pleasure of working with a very innovative AO that thinks outside the box and allows for a lot of flexibility. And people say they want that, right? But then when it comes down to the program side of the house, they truly do not understand how to implement what it is he's asking for. So they don't know how to get after that. So they still, even though he's talking very, you know, innovative, and I'm only doing this and I'm using Agile. But when you get to the program office and the ISMs, they're using typical RMF. Now they're giving him the documents that he wants, but they're going to lean right back on that typical RMF process if you don't truly give them like implementation guides. And it's, you know what, and people are busy. So people are just trying to get through this. They don't have time to come up with a whole new CATO process, you know, to implement kind of these AO thresholds. And so understanding even from the program office that, you know what, there sometimes is a middle layer that's missing that I have seen. And that is that liaison, helping bring in all those communities together. But specifically to what a lot of people saying, really the AO is very important in understanding what their tolerance and thresholds are, but how do we effectively communicate that not only to the program, then the developers, and even within the programs, there's different levels of communication from an ISM who's more so worried about kind of the management, you know, managing their schedule, down to the developers that's in the program, down to the operational people that's going to actually use this pipeline to develop code. They all have a different intent and perspective. And how do you communicate this to them where it's a win-win and you can bring everyone together, especially when typically people don't necessarily like us assess and authorize people. we're not the most liked group of folks, but you know, so, and we're not typically the most collaborative group of folks either. So that's all.
I like what Lanya said there. Like Anna just asked a question about like how do we standardize, and I think Lanya, you said some things about pipelines, and that's a set of standardized ways that you could achieve some of that ANA type function. But I also think to your broader point that I don't have an answer for right now. Is there, to me, there needs to be definitely a thought of like how we do these roles and what the incentives are of each org, because they don't align properly, in my opinion. Like I'm a perfectionist in a bad way, in that like you give me a checklist and you're like, hey, you know, you're supposed to do this security thing. And I look at it and I'm like, well, okay, like I can do that, but like, it's not really secure. And then like the ANA person comes and they're like, well, you need to do it this way. And I'm like, but that's not really good. But if I tell you that, then you're going to tell me I can't go. And it's like the incentives are messed up there. I should be able to tell you that and then have you come back and be like, huh, interesting. Like maybe we need to figure out a new way to do this, but I'm not going to shut you down for the next 3 years until you like, there has to be better alignment of like, we all want to deliver outcomes to, you know, the mission, and it can't be this thing where we have siloed orgs where it's like, my only goal is to make sure we're secure. And it's like, well, that's not really a state. Let's be honest. Like you can't really get there. You can try to get as close as possible.
But they say it's a journey, not a destination.
It sounds like, Lanya, what you're suggesting is the way to solve for this is by pushing all the way to the left here and getting contracts structured in a way that from an acquisition perspective, that third party assessor and the AO's organization and anybody who's involved here is incentivized to collaborate.
Yes. And, you know, the government definitely has to get away from these low cost contracts. And I'm not saying that because I have a GovCon company. I'm saying that in the world is changing and security personnel are sought after. And then the government put these contracts out from a support perspective at a low cost. So you think you're going to get some workforce in there that's amazing. And you're not, because cybersecurity personnel have lots of options. And so, and even if they do come in to get experience in DevSecOps, they will surely leave once they get trained up and get a better opportunity. So we have to figure out, how do we retain, you know, what is that? What is, how do we retain our workforce after they're trained, but also how do we, and even in the government side, you know, and I don't mean this to be even, you know, derogatory, but, you know, from a leadership perspective on the government side, they are struggling now. And because you can't, it's very difficult to offer someone that's going to do DevSecOps on the government side a GS-13, right? But maybe you don't, but they're not going to offer them a 15, but it's going to be hard to find a person that's going to appropriately manage something like this at the GS level that they will offer these positions. So they have to look at the structure of the workforce on the government side, as well as how they let contracts. So I just want to say that it's broader than the contracts portion of it. And then acquisitions, really holding people, holding, you know, I'm a real fan of accountability. You know, I say that to my team. I mean that to my, any contractor, even government people. I mean, we have to be held accountable for our, whatever we're responsible for. And sometimes I've also seen kind of the government bringing these large vendors and spend a lot of money on contracts and not effectively managing and then not holding them accountable. And you look 5 years later, we haven't moved, you know, we haven't moved forward. And they didn't hold the folks accountable that were supposed to deliver the secure systems. Because security comes from secure development, system development lifecycle, not from security people. Most of the times what we're asking for, once you talk about assessing authorized, that should have been done. You know, that a ConOps, all those things, those should have been in place already. I shouldn't be asking for that many things that's new. Your architecture, how, you know, your interconnections, how will you access this? Those things should have been done in the build process. And so, yeah, so I think that, yeah, we have to collaborate. It is on the, you know, the acquisition or contract side, Mikey, to your point, but also workforce on the government side of the house as well needs to be addressed.
Yes. So remember earlier you asked why is it so difficult? Why do we only see a few programs do this? We've only talked about pretty much like programmatic, you know, process, human aspects of this. We haven't even touched on the technical stuff quite yet. And she has laid out a whole slew of things that are challenging. So that's, you know, summarizes why it's so difficult.
So there are a bunch of questions here in the chat. We've got 7 minutes left. I'm not really sure which question to ask. I'm wondering if either of you are looking at this.
I'll read one now. Each and every AO has their own risk profile. Is there a way that we can get to some sort of set of risk profiles at the enterprise level that will help drive some standardization in this area?
Steve had a good answer to that in the chat. If you want to hop in, Steve.
Exactly. And yep, all these professionals, I guess you can come off mute too and help. Jump in. Okay, Steve, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. No. I'm reading through the chats.
Yeah, so that question was to you, Steve, the question regarding like the standardized risk profile. And you had a decent, I thought it was a good answer in the chat there.
Yeah. I mean, I love, you know, and Anna's follow-up question, right? Her follow-up, well, we've got, you know, all these other classification levels. The problem at the end of the day is, you know, take an AO who's authorizing the use of applications, you know, in a specific theater of operations for a specific set of outcomes. Their risk profile is going to be difficult to dictate ahead of time, right? Because they're making decisions at the speed of battle in some cases, right? It would be awesome if we could say, hey, here's a global set of risk patterns that the AOs could choose from as they're setting their guidelines for things around continuous development, agile development, et cetera. But the truth of the matter is we have so many AOs because we have so many distinct mission areas and distinct sets of responsibilities. And we delegate to those AOs the responsibility to decide ultimately what their risk posture needs to be because, right, they are in these uniquely different areas. And so I posit, right, this statement that says, if we could better define the risk pictures globally up front, we wouldn't need so many AOs and wouldn't delegate so much decision authority to them, right?
I agree, Stephen. I think we, you know, what's seen on the Air Force, the AO structure is very decentralized. And it's based off of, you know, functional areas, right? Which seems to be very helpful. But as we move into this new space, and I guess I shouldn't say this because we don't want to decrease the amount of contract support we need. But what's happening now is now you have 27 AOs. Within 27 AOs, 15 are trying to build a DevOps pipeline and move to the cloud. They do not have the workforce. So guess what? Now you have to have 15 sets of this workforce and this skill, and there's no way to centralize the support that they are getting. And so it is causing... it's really not a good way forward. And we really have to think about in this new world, what is the new structure for authorization? You know, because we do have to share resources. There's not a lot of folks in this space. And that's another reason back to one of your questions earlier, Mikey, was why people are not, you know, being able to implement this. They're saying, hey, I want CATO, but it goes back to, again, that if we're so decentralized and to the person's question in the chat, with different thresholds, sometimes they're using different language, so you can't use reciprocity, you know? And so we need some guidance and rails, and even the Air Force has tried to come out with a set of risk standards and guardrails. And out of the 27 AOs, you know, 20 of them like that process and like being prescriptive, and there's 7 over here are not happy that you told them that this is the threshold that they have to meet, and they are a unique organization. They want to create their own. So it's a tough problem set because you're trying to appease so many different people, and even the AOs have different skill sets, and some of them have, the majority of them have full-time jobs. You know, I do think the risk profile from a enterprise level though, is important because at the end of the day, you know, even though it's delegated, that CIO is accepting that risk. They should have some form of a baseline to say, if you are on my enterprise at a minimum, you have to meet these standards. I'm not going to tell you how, right? But I'm just going to tell you, you know, so you can decide what tool, what people will process, but to be on my enterprise, you must meet these standards. I do think that that's important.
I do want to briefly look at Aaron's question. He's like, how do we affect change? I think Lanya makes a great point about compensation for cyber type people. Does the government have an out of band pay structure? And I think like one thing that everybody here, specifically me, can say is like, I have no idea what is going to happen in the future, but I know that Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, went on and people were like, hey, what do you think about inflation? Like, you're putting a lot of money into the economy. And he's like, yeah, it's risky, but that's cybersecurity stuff. Ooh, now y'all need to be watching out for that. And like, this is the chairman of the Fed. Like, this is not like, you know, somebody over, you know, any AG. No, this is the chairman of the Fed saying cybersecurity is the biggest risk we face in America right now. So I don't know how we affect change on the individual level beyond be good collaborators, like Lanya said, learn. Maybe it's private sector that comes in and comes and like these orgs start coming in with really strong teams like the Steves of the world that are at Oracle making great, you know, secure products, same for whatever vendor, I don't care. And I don't think it should matter all that much at the end of the day, but now is the time for you to strike while the iron's hot and make sure you have like pushed yourself forward to be at the cutting edge of really trying to deliver secure software. And I guarantee you will affect change one way or another.
Just one point before we leave. And so I wanted to just mention what you just said about bringing in the Steves and the Oracles of the world. You know, I think DoD have been so scared to collaborate with vendors, right? To have, they didn't have an open door policy with vendors or, you know, industry that's actually doing this. And so now I think I see government kind of changing a little and having more, having more collaborative functions with the vendors. And we had not seen that in the past, but I think it's, you know, so important for that to bring that skill set into the government.
I feel like this conversation should be like an offsite. We should next time, let's do this in Tahoe in a 5-day retreat.
Over lemon drop martinis.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll be back then if that's the case.
Yeah. What I think I'm hearing is policy up here and aiming an outcome and put together a formula with a risk tolerant AO, CISO, CIO here and try to meet these things in the middle over time. This is an incredible conversation. It sucks that we have to be done here. Maybe let's pick this up for a bonus session sometime in the near future. Thank you all for joining us. This was killer. I think it's gonna get posted somewhere. And so share it with your friends if they didn't get a chance to make it.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deft.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deft.org/join. That's deft.org/join.